The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is George Douglas from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And welcome to our program for this week. We're reading from the Week magazine edition, dated April 20th, 2012. And our first article comes from the main story section of the Week magazine. It's entitled, Doubts About the Economic Recovery. What happened? The U.S. jobs market appears to be slowing its stride, raising fears this past week that a nascent economic recovery is losing momentum. Employers added just 120,000 jobs in March, according to the Labor Department, well below economists' expectations and less than half the average 246,000 new jobs added in each of the previous 3 months. In a reversal of recent trends, retailers shed nearly 34,000 jobs, construction lost 7,000, and temp work fell by 7,500. But manufacturing continued a robust run, adding 37,000 jobs, and analysts were heartened by the fact that government employment fell by only 1,000 workers, suggesting that public sector cuts are easing. The unemployment rate fell slightly from 8.3% to 8.2%, but the decline came largely as a result of people leaving the workforce. Both political parties attempted to spin the mixed report to their advantage. A cautiously upbeat President Obama noted that the economy has still added more than 600,000 jobs since January 1. There will still be ups and downs along the way, he said. We've got a lot more work to do. Republicans argue that the latest figures highlight the failure of Obama's economic policies. Presumptive GOP presidential nominee Mitt Romney called March's jobs gain weak and very troubling and said the president's excuses have run out. Here's what the editorial said. Just like last year, a winter recovery appears to be turning into a spring stall, said the Wall Street Journal. Workers continue to abandon the labor force in droves, and any gains we saw in recent months were probably the result of the warmer than usual winter, giving the construction industry a head start on spring. The economy's continued fragility is all the more astonishing given the 3 years of unprecedented fiscal and monetary stimulus President Obama has thrown at it, including a $100 billion payroll tax holiday this year. To be fair, the economy is still headed in the right direction, said Bloomberg.com, but the recovery is not so strong that the country's politicians couldn't still kill it off. The expiration of the Bush tax cuts and the start of $1.2 trillion in spending cuts at the end of 2012 could trigger a renewed recession that might permanently stunt the economy's growth. President Obama and Congress should take this disappointing report as a warning that the economy cannot withstand either tax increases or major cuts in spending. Now here's what the columnist had to say. One bad report does not a trend make, said Felix Salmon in Reuters.com. The March jobs figures are likely to be revised upward when more complete data become available. And even if 120,000 new jobs disappoints today, it's worth recalling that not long ago this figure would have been taken as something decidedly encouraging. It's not encouraging that more people have given up looking for work, said Matthew O'Brien in TheAtlantic.com, but it isn't necessarily proof that the economy is slumping again. More baby boomers in their late 50s and early 60s are reacting to hard times by retiring early, while young people are stalling by going to graduate school. Still, there's plenty of reason for concern, said Robert Reich and CSMonitor.com. Employers won't continue to hire unless consumer spending justifies it. With most gains going to the top 1% and personal income stagnating, consumers' pockets are almost empty. Expect an anemic jobs recovery in the months ahead. That's hardly what Obama wants to hear, said James Politi in the Financial Times. The president was hoping to kick off the two-man general election with strong economic data at his back. Any overconfidence at campaign headquarters has now been wiped out. In fact, said John Podhoretz in the New York Post, the dynamics of the presidential race just shifted. The president acknowledged his acute vulnerability by saying that we should expect continued ups and downs in coming months. But a real recovery is ups without downs. No matter how Obama and his team spin the numbers, he'll be in big trouble this November if he faces the voters with an economy little better than it is now. The next item on the international front, nuclear talks with Iran. Iran said it would present new proposals at critical nuclear talks with the U.S. and other world powers this past week, hinting that it was prepared to limit its production of highly enriched uranium. The U.S. has raised concerns about Iran's stockpiling of uranium enriched to 20% fissile purity, which can be turned into weapons-grade material in a matter of months. But days before the start of negotiations in Istanbul, Feridun Abbasi, head of Iran's Atomic Energy Organization, said the country might stop higher-grade enrichment as soon as it had enough fuel to power a medical research reactor. Abbasi's proposal falls far short of the Obama administration's demands that the regime transfer its stockpile of highly enriched uranium out of the country and dismantle its recently completed underground nuclear site at Fordo. Iran's foreign minister, Ali Abkar Saleh, said the regime would accept no conditions set before the talks. Here we go again, said Benny Avni in the New York Post. Just as it did before previous talks, the Iranian regime is floating compromises so that it can drag out negotiations while continuing to advance its nuclear weapons program. Sadly, Obama is willing to play along with the mullah's game as he thinks the status quo is good enough to let him highlight his national security credentials on the campaign trail. But Obama has already doomed these talks to failure, said Paul Pillar in the National Interest. By demanding the dismantling of the Fordo facility, where Iran produces all of its highly enriched uranium, he sent a message that the West will only tolerate an Iranian nuclear program consisting of facilities that would suffer significant damage if we or the Israelis later decide to bomb. That proposal won't inspire trust, let alone agreement from Iran's leaders. It's a tough offer, said Rula Khalaf in the Financial Times, but Iran can't afford to refuse it. This round of talks really is the regime's last chance. If the negotiations fail, Israel will almost certainly bomb Iran's nuclear sites, an act that could provoke a wider regional conflict. Iran will no doubt resist calls to close Fordo, but given the high stakes, defiance would be the more damaging of options. The next item, back in the U.S., Santorum bows out. Rick Santorum suspended his presidential campaign last week, clearing the way for Mitt Romney to claim the Republican primary race unhindered. With his strong backing from evangelical and ultra-conservative Republicans, Santorum had been the last candidate with any chance of denying Romney the nomination. But with his campaign around $1 million in debt, his disabled infant daughter hospitalized over the weekend, and Romney's lead in the delegate count all but insurmountable, Santorum decided it was time to drop out. In his farewell speech, the former senator said he would continue to go out and fight and defeat President Barack Obama, but did not mention Romney by name. Romney calls Santorum an able and worthy competitor and an important voice in our party. Rick Santorum's achievement in this race shouldn't be underestimated, said Rich Lowry in NationalReview.com. He started out with little more than convictions and a shoestring, but ended up winning 11 state contests and galvanizing evangelical voters by refusing to compromise his moral principles. His failures to expand on that base sealed his defeat, but he can exit this race with his head held high. Yes, Santorum did more with less than almost any candidate in history, said Jonathan Chait in NYMag.com. Not only did he have no money or organization, he had no ideas except to bring back the social and sexual mores of the 1950s. He only survived this long because every other conservative option had either been destroyed by Romney's money or collapsed on its own. The idea that this moralistic Washington retread has a national political future is comical. Give him more credit than that, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. Santorum's rousing campaign theme of rebuilding America made Romney's recitation of his resume look flat by comparison. Santorum forced the likely presidential candidate to lift his performance and improve his platform, making him a stronger contender in the long run. If Romney wins in November, Santorum's strong run will be a part of the victory story. And now we'll turn to the controversy of the week. The Supreme Court. Did Obama try to bully the justices? Barack Obama isn't the first president to criticize a Supreme Court ruling, said Jim Powell in Forbes.com, but he might be the first to do so while the justices are still deliberating. Last week, in a blatant attempt to intimidate the Supreme Court into upholding his health care law, Obama publicly reminded the justices that they're an elected group of people and warned them not to take the unprecedented, extraordinary step of overturning a law that was passed by a strong majority of a democratically elected Congress. That's the kind of chilling presidential warning you'd expect in places like Balochistan, said Mark Stein in NationalReview.com. In our free society, the Supreme Court has not only the power, but the responsibility to ensure that the president and Congress do not overstep their constitutional boundaries. The only thing unprecedented here is the Supreme Court actively deliberating on a crucial case while our power-mad president is idly swinging his tire iron and saying, "Nice little Supreme Court you got here. Shame if anything were to happen to it." It's just silly to think Obama's trying to intimidate the court, said Jonathan Cohn in TNR.com. He didn't threaten to impeach the justices or to ignore their ruling if it goes against him. He merely said he was confident the justices would uphold the law. Given what's at stake here, the possibility that five conservative justices would deprive tens of millions of people of health insurance, Obama has a duty to speak out. The right-wing outrage at his remarks is laughable, said Jeff Shisol in TheDailyBeast.com. Republicans call for the impeachment of liberal members of the Warren Court after its civil rights rulings in the 1960s and 70s, and after Roe v. Wade in 1973. Fiery denunciations of unelected tyrants legislating from the bench became the Republican boilerplate. The power struggle between the courts and the presidency is one of the defining conflicts in our national life, and presidents have every right to use their bully pulpit in that tug of war. If anything, said Marvin Amori in TheAtlantic.com, Obama was too mild in his criticism. From the shameless Bush versus Gore ruling that decided the 2000 general election to the Citizens United decision allowing billionaires and corporations to spend unlimited sums corrupting our political system, right-wing Supreme Court justices have demonstrated blatant pro-Republican partisanship. If the current court majority want to indulge their partisan biases in an unending series of 5-4 rulings, they should be subjected to the same political arguments and passions to which we subject the rest of Washington. Under Chief Justice John Roberts, the court has demonstrated a distinct agenda, said E.J. Dionne in the Washington Post. Its goal is to roll back the New Deal and 80 years of judicial precedent, stripping away protection from consumers, workers, and the poor, and giving corporations and the rich unchallenged power. Conservatives are in shock that Obama dared challenge this radical power grab. They prefer passive, intimidated liberals to the fighting kind. Clearly, both sides Clearly, both sides are guilty of hypocrisy, said Steve Chapman in the Chicago Tribune. But it's now the turn of liberals to learn the hard lesson that conservatives spent decades learning. The way to influence Supreme Court rulings is not through whining or threats, but by winning elections and appointing justices who share your views. No, the process isn't quick or easy or guaranteed to succeed. But whoever said that it ought to be? And now we'll turn to the popular column in the Week magazine called A Good Week For and A Bad Week For. It was a good week for family ties after Charles Ferguson of Greer, South Carolina, said he would ignore local officials' order that he get rid of his pet goat, Yogi, even though he faces fines and jail. That's like asking me to get rid of one of my kids, Ferguson said. It's not going to happen. It was a good week for never giving up hope after Monica Moser of Germany was reunited with her cat 16 years after it went missing. A hiker found the cat, which apparently had been living in the woods the entire time. And it was a good week for Laura Penny, a British journalist, after heartthrob actor Ryan Gosling grabbed her just as she stepped into the path of a New York City cab. I literally just got saved from a car by Ryan Gosling, Penny tweeted. Literally, that actually just happened. It was a bad week for Ozzie Guillen, manager of baseball's Miami Marlins, after he alienated much of the team's fan base by saying he loved and respected Fidel Castro. Guillen begged for forgiveness and was suspended for 5 games, but Cuban American groups say they won't stop protesting until he's fired. It was a bad week for stealing technology after Raymond Jefferson was charged with stealing $17,000 worth of merchandise from a Radio Shack in Chicago, including a GPS device that police used to locate him. And it was a bad week for swallowing your own medicine after Henrik Ismarker of Stockholm complained to police that too many cars were speeding on a street near his home. The next day he was caught in a police speed trap there. Ismarker said he was embarrassed but very satisfied with the police response. And now we'll flip through to the People section of the Week magazine for this week. Our first article this week is entitled, Jones Gangland Childhood. Music saved Quincy Jones, said Dylan Jones in GQ. Growing up in Chicago's South Side in the 1930s, the producer didn't have much of a family life. His mother was incarcerated in a mental asylum while his carpenter father struggled with single parenthood. Jones and his younger brother Lloyd ran free, doing small jobs for mobsters. Until I was 11, a gangster was all I wanted to be, he says. I saw terrible things in Chicago. Dead bodies, piles of bloody money, dirty cops, dirty women, Tommy guns. I saw it all. When Jones was 10, his father remarried and the family moved to Bremerton near Seattle, but he continued his criminal liaisons, running errands for local prostitutes and pimps. At age 11, he broke into the neighborhood recreation center and stumbled across an upright piano. He tapped a key and the sound of that note changed everything. As soon as I hit it, I knew I was gone. The concept of playing music never occurred to me, even though it was around all the time in Chicago, said Jones, who went on to produce hits for everyone from Frank Sinatra to Michael Jackson. I knew right there and then that this was what I wanted to do for the rest of my life. It saved my life. The next article is the Olympian who raised a Black Power salute. John Carlos paid a heavy price for his act of protest, said Gary Young in The Guardian. At the 1968 Mexico City Olympic Games, sprinter Carlos and his U.S. teammate Tommy Smith raised their fists in a Black Power salute after winning bronze and gold medals in the 200-meter dash. The gesture, says Carlos, was meant to tell the world that just because we have USA on our chest does not mean everything is peachy keen for blacks in America. He vividly remembers the stadium going quiet as he lifted his arm. You could have heard a frog pee on cotton. There's something awful about hearing 50,000 people go silent, like being in the eye of a hurricane. The men were expelled from the Olympics and suspended from the U.S. team. Back in America, few people would employ Carlos, and his marriage collapsed under the pressure. When there's a lack of money, it brings contempt to the family. As the backlash waned, Carlos was invited back into the Olympic fold, helping to reorganize the Los Angeles Games in 1984. But he insists his radicalism didn't die with readmission to the Olympic family. The image of the salute is still there, he says. So many people find inspiration in that portrait. That's what I was born for. And our next article is Ono's Lost Family. Yoko Ono gave up a lot for John Lennon, said Chrissy Illy in the Daily Telegraph. Before she fell in love with Lennon, she was an established artist. Afterwards, she became part of a duo that eclipsed them both. In a way, John and I ruined our careers by getting together, she says. Beatles fans were horrified by the union, as was her aristocratic family back in Tokyo. My mother was hurt when she heard I had gone off with a working-class guy from Liverpool. The family put out a press release saying, "We are not proud of Yoko Ono." Worse, her then-husband, Tony Cox, disappeared with their 7-year-old daughter, Kyoko, fearing he would lose custody of the girl to Ono and Lennon. By the time Ono saw her daughter again, Kyoko was 31. "It was hard. I remembered her as a little girl, and I kept buying her small cashmere sweaters. They piled up in my dressing room until someone said to me, 'Do you realize she's now 26? Why are you keeping these things?'" She says, "Kyoko had so much love for her father, and he had said very clearly that if he searched me out, she would never see him again." And you're listening to our Reading of the Week magazine for this week, April 20th, 2012. We're going to the briefing section now, and the next article is entitled "The Rise of Atheism." The number of atheists is growing, but they remain America's least trusted minority. Why? How many atheists are there? It depends on your definition of the term. Only between 1.5% and 4% of Americans admit to so-called hard atheism, the conviction that no higher power exists. But a much larger share of the American public, 19%, spurns organized religion in favor of a non-defined skepticism about faith. This group, sometimes collectively labeled the nuns, is growing faster than any religious faith in the U.S. About two-thirds of nuns say they are former believers. 24% are lapsed Catholics, and 29% once identified with other Christian denominations. David Silverman, president of American Atheists, claiming these nuns, and that's like none of the above, not nuns as in the Catholic nuns, of course, but these nuns as members of his tribe, "If you don't have a belief in God, you're an atheist," he said. "It doesn't matter what you call yourself." Why are so many people leaving religion? It's primarily a backlash against the religious right, say political scientists Robert Putman and David Campbell. In their book, American Grace, they argue that the religious right's politicization of faith in the 1990s turned younger, socially liberal Christians away from churches, even as conservatives became more zealous. The dropouts were turned off by churches' Old Testament condemnation of homosexuals, premarital sex, contraception, and abortion. The Catholic Church's sex scandals also prompted millions to equate religion with moralistic hypocrisy. While the Republican base has become ever more committed to mixing religion and politics, Putnam and Campbell write, the rest of the country has been moving in the opposite direction. As society becomes more secular, researchers say, doubters are more confident about identifying themselves as non-believers. The collapse of institutional religion in the first 10 years of this century has freed so many people to say they don't really care, said author Diana Butler Bass. How are non-believers perceived? Most polls suggest that atheists are among the most disliked groups in the U.S. One study last year asked participants whether a fictional hit-and-run driver was more likely to be an atheist or a rapist. A majority chose atheist. In 2006, another study found that Americans rated atheists as less likely to agree with their vision of America than Muslims, Hispanics, or homosexuals. Wherever there are religious majorities, atheists are among the least trusted people, said University of British Columbia sociologist Will M. Gervais. As a result, avowed atheists are rare in nearly all areas of public life. Of the 535 legislators in Congress, for example, only one, Representative Peake Stark, a Democrat from California, calls himself an atheist. Few sports stars or Hollywood celebrities own up to having no religious faith. Why so much distrust? Many Americans raised in the Judeo-Christian tradition are convinced that atheists can have no moral compass. Azim Sharif, a University of Oregon psychologist who studies religious thinking, sums up how believers view non-believers. They don't fear God, so we should distrust them. They do not have the same moral obligations as others. The antipathy may have actually grown with the recent emergence of new atheist writers, such as Richard Dawkins and the late Christopher Hitchens, who have launched impassioned attacks on organized religion. Dawkins has encouraged his followers to ridicule anyone who could believe in an unforgiving control freak and a capriciously malevolent bully, like the God portrayed in the Old Testament. Dawkins' harsh approach, said Barbara J. King, an anthropologist at the College of William and Mary, has confirmed some of the negative stereotypes associated with the non-religious, intolerance of the faithful first and foremost. How have atheists responded to this negative image? A coalition of non-believers is out to make atheism more acceptable, starting with last month's Reason Rally on the National Mall in Washington, D.C., where thousands stood up for their right to not believe. Silverman of American Atheists, who helped organize the rally, said it was intended to give heart to young, closet atheists who fear the social stigma of being outed, in much the same way closeted gays do. We will never be closeted again, he said. Some within the movement advocate taking a more conciliatory approach to believers, too. Alan de Botton, the Anglo-Swiss writer of the new book Religion for Atheists, assails Dawkins as being very narrow-minded and praises religions as the most successful educational and intellectual movements the planet has ever witnessed. Will atheism ever be accepted? If growth continues at the current rate, 1 in 4 Americans will profess no religious faith within 20 years. Silverman hopes that as non-belief spreads, atheists can become a legitimate political segment of the American population, afforded the same protections as religious groups and ethnic minorities. But he's not advocating a complete secular takeover of the U.S., nor would he likely be likely to to achieve one, given the abiding religious faith of most Americans. We don't want the obliteration of religion. We don't want religion wiped off the face of the earth, Silverman said. All we demand is equality. And the footnote to this article, Atheists in Foxholes. Atheists are barely visible in politics and entertainment, but they are clamoring for recognition in another area of public life, the military. The Military Association of Atheists and Freethinkers estimates that 40,000 soldiers identify as non-believers and counts the most famous casualty of the war in Afghanistan, former NFL star Pat Tillman, as one of its own. In attempting to secure the same rights and support enjoyed by religious soldiers, the association lobbies against the idea that there are no atheists in foxholes and wants atheist chaplains made available for the ranks of the armed non-believers. Jason Torpy, the association's president, says that non-believers outnumber every religious group in the military except Christians, yet receive no ethical and family counseling geared to their own non-beliefs. These are things that chaplains do for everybody, he said, except for us. Now, from the Week magazine for this week, let's take a look at the best column sections according to the Week magazine. Our first one is entitled, How Romney Can Win Over Women Voters. It was written by Michael Gerson in the Washington Post. Mitt Romney still has a chance to address his women problem, said Michael Gerson. Polls show him trailing Barack Obama among women by as much as 18 points in swing states such as Ohio. But they also show that this gender gap wasn't caused by Romney's opposition to a contraception mandate for religious institutions, as liberals contend. Women are turned off by Romney because they see him as coldly ideological. To appeal to the GOP's Tea Party base, Romney has become harsh on immigration, confrontational on social issues, simplistic in condemning government, and silent on the struggles of the poor. Do women like men without empathy? No. The last time Republicans won the White House, they did so with George W. Bush's compassionate conservatism, which emphasized improving schools, humane immigration reform, and faith-based care for the poor. Republicans now scorn all that at their peril. To win in November, Romney has to do more than promise to cut spending and taxes. He needs a positive vision that includes all Americans, not just conservative males. He needs to show some humanity. The next column from the week is called Stripping Away Our Right to Privacy by Noah Feldman in Bloomberg.com. Privacy as we know it is dying, said Noah Feldman. The latest evidence of this alarming trend came in the U.S. Supreme Court decision last week allowing corrections officials to strip search anyone entering prison, even for trivial offenses such as a routine traffic stop. The majority opinion in the 5-4 decision was written by Justice Anthony Kennedy, who in the past has been deeply sympathetic to arguments on human dignity, defending gays and women's rights to choose an abortion. So why was Kennedy untroubled by prison guards inspecting all inmates' genitals and body cavities? Largely, this ruling reflects our society's diminished expectation of privacy. Every day, Americans are now monitored by cameras in public places. To get on a commercial airplane, you must step into airport scanners that show you essentially naked. Our emails and Google searches are studied and compiled. It's not a big jump to believe that an inmate, even one merely awaiting trial, has no privacy rights whatsoever. Warning, prisoners are really just guinea pigs for the rest of us. And the third column for this week is When Racism is Too Blatant to Ignore by Peter Beinart in thedailybeast.com. It takes real courage for conservative pundits or politicians to admit that racism even exists, said Peter Beinart. That's why National Review editor Rich Lowry deserves congratulations for firing contributing writer John Derbyshire last week for a blatantly racist screed he wrote for a hard right website. In Derbyshire's jaw-dropping piece, a bitter response to black columnists writing about the Trayvon Martin case, he provided advice to his own children about dealing with black people. He told them that most blacks are not very intelligent and that some are ferociously hostile to whites, warning his kids to leave as quickly as possible any place or event in which the number of blacks suddenly swells. Rank-and-file conservatives ferociously objected to Derbyshire's sacking, claimed he merely stated what most whites privately believe. How revealing. Sadly, the conservative movement still relies overwhelmingly on whites who fear and dislike blacks, Latinos, immigrants, gays, and Muslims. In sacking a member of the conservative club, Lowry struck a blow for something this country desperately needs, an anti-racist conservative movement. And now we will flip to the back of the Week magazine for this week to take a look at the last word. The article this week is entitled, My Digital Shadow. Who's following my every move on the web, asks Alexis Madrigal, and what do they want from me? This morning, if you opened your browser and went to the nytimes.com, an amazing thing happened in the milliseconds between your click and when the news about North Korea or James Murdoch appeared on your screen. Data from this single visit was sent to 10 different companies, including Microsoft and Google's subsidiaries, a gaggle of traffic logging sites, and other smaller ad firms. Nearly instantaneously, these companies can log your visit, place ads tailored for your eyes specifically, and add to the ever-growing online file about you. There's nothing necessarily sinister about this subterranean data exchange. This is, after all, the advertising ecosystem that supports free online content. All the data lets advertisers fine-tune their ads, and the rest of the information, logging, lets them measure how well things are actually working. And I do not mean to pick on the New York Times. While visiting the Huffington Post or the Atlantic or Business Insider, the same process happens to a greater or lesser degree. Every move you make on the Internet is worth some tiny amount to someone, and a panoply of companies want to make sure that no step along your Internet journey goes unmonetized. Even if you are generally familiar with the idea of data collection for targeted advertising, the number and variety of these data collectors will probably astonish you. Allow me to introduce the list of companies that tracked my movements on the Internet in one recent 36-hour period of standard web surfing. Acerno, Adara Media, AdBlade, AdBright, ADC Onion, Alchemy, Adify, AdMeld, AdTech, Aggregate Knowledge, AlmondNet, Aperture, AppNexus, Atlas, Audience Science. And that's just the A's. My complete list includes 105 companies, and there are dozens more than that in existence. You, too, could compile your own list using Mozilla's tool Collusion, which records the companies that are capturing data about you, or more precisely, your digital self. While the big names, Google, Microsoft, Facebook, Yahoo, etc., show up in this catalog, the bulk of it is comprised of smaller data and advertising businesses that form a shadow web of companies that want to help show you advertising that you're more likely to click on and products that you're more likely to purchase. To be clear, these companies gather data without attaching it to your name. They use that data to show you ads you are statistically more likely to click. That's the game, and there is substantial money in it. As users, we move through our Internet experiences unaware of the churning subterranean machines powering our web pages, with their cookies and pixel trackers, their tracking code and databases. We shop for wedding caterers and suddenly see Ring ads appear on random web pages we're visiting. We sometimes think the ads following us around the Internet are creepy. We sometimes feel watched. Does it matter? We don't really know what to think. The issues the industry raises did not exist when Ronald Reagan was president and were only in nascent form when the Twin Towers fell. These are phenomena of our time, and while there are many antecedent forms of advertising, never before in the history of human experience has so much data been gathered about so many people for the sole purpose of selling them ads. The best minds of my generation are thinking about how to make people click ads. My old friend and early Facebook employee, Jeff Hammerbacher, once said, "That sucks," he added. But increasingly, I think these issues, how we move freely online, or more properly, how we pay one way or another, are actually the leading edge of a much bigger discussion about the relationship between our digital and physical selves. I don't mean theoretically or psychologically. I mean that the norms established to improve how often people click ads may end up determining who you are when viewed by a bank or a romantic partner or a retailer that sells shoes. Already the websites you visit reshape themselves before you like a carnivorous school of fish, and this is only the beginning. Right now, a huge chunk of what you've ever looked for on the internet is sitting in databases all across the world. The line separating all that it might say about you, good or bad, is as thin as the letters of your name. If and when that wall breaks down, the numbers may overwhelm the name. The unconsciously created profile may mean more than the examined self I've sought to build. Most privacy debates have been couched in the technical. We read about how Google bypassed Safari's privacy settings, whatever those were, or we read the details about how Facebook tracks you with those friendly like buttons. Behind the details, however, are a tangle of philosophical issues that are at the heart of the struggle between privacy advocates and online advertising companies. What is anonymity? What is identity? How similar are humans and machines? This essay is an attempt to think through those questions. The bad news is that people haven't taken control of the data that's being collected and traded about them. The good news is that, in a quite literal sense, simply thinking differently about this advertising business can change the way that it works. After all, if you take these companies at their word, they exist to serve users as much as to serve their clients. At the heart of the problem is that we increasingly live two lives, a physical one in which your name, social security number, passport number, and driver's license are your main identity markers, and one digital, in which you have dozens of identity markers which are known to you and me as cookies. These markers allow data gatherers to keep tabs on you without your name. Those cookie numbers, which are known only to the entities that assign them to you, are persistent markers of who you are, but they remain unattached to your physical identity through your name. There is a thin wall between the self that buys health insurance and the self that searches for health-related information online. For real-time advertising bidding, in which audiences are being served ads that were purchased milliseconds after users arrive at a web page, ad services match cookies so that both sides know who a user is. While that information may not be stored by both companies, i.e., it's not added to a user's persistent file, it means that the walls between online data selves are falling away quickly. Everyone can know who you are, even if they call you by a different number. Furthermore, when many companies are just out there collecting data to sell to other companies, anyone can combine multiple databases together into a fully fleshed-out digital portrait. As a Wall Street Journal investigation put it, data companies are transforming the Internet into a place where people are becoming anonymous in name only. If a company can follow your behavior in the digital environment, an environment that potentially includes your mobile phone and television set, its claim that you are anonymous is meaningless. That is particularly true when firms intermittently add offline information, such as shopping patterns and the value of your house, to their online data, and then simply strip the name and address to make it anonymous. It matters little if your name is John Smith, Yesh Mispar, or 3211466. The persistence of information about you will lead firms to act based on what they know, share, and care about you, whether you know it is happening or not. Militating against this collapse of privacy is a protection embedded in the very nature of the online advertising system. No person could ever actually look over the world's web tracks. It would be too expensive, and even if you had all the human laborers in the world, they couldn't do the math fast enough to constantly recalculate web surfers' value to advertisers. So machines are the ones that do all the work. When new technologies come up against our expectations of privacy, I think it's helpful to make a real-world analogy. But we just do not have an adequate understanding of anonymity in a world where machines can parse all of our behavior without human oversight. Most obviously, with the machine, you have more privacy than if a person were watching your click streams, picking up collateral knowledge. A human could easily apply analytical reasoning skills to figure out who you were. Any human could use this data for unauthorized purposes. With our data-driven advertising world, we are relying on machines' current dumbness and inability to know too much. This is a double-edged sword. The current levels of machine intelligence insulate us from privacy catastrophe, so we let data be collected about us. But we know that this data is not going away, and yet machine intelligence is growing rapidly. The results of this process are ineluctable. Left to their own devices, ad tracking firms will eventually be able to connect your various data selves. And then they will break down the name wall if they are allowed to. The advertising lobby is explicitly opposed to setting browser defaults for higher levels of do not track privacy. If it is successful, there will be nothing to protect the vast majority of Internet users from unwittingly giving away vast amounts of data about who they are. On the other hand, these are the tools that allow websites to eke out a tiny bit more money than they otherwise would. I am all too aware of how difficult it is for media businesses to survive in this new environment. Sure, we could all throw up paywalls and try to make a lot more money from a lot fewer readers, but that would destroy what makes the web the unique resource in human history that it is. I wish there were more obvious villains in this story. The saving grace may end up being that as companies go to more obtrusive and higher production value ads, targeting may become ineffective. Avi Goldfarb of the Rotman School of Management and Catherine Tucker of MIT's Sloan School found last year that the big obtrusive ads that marketers love do not work better with targeting, but worse. And lo and behold, the failure appears to be related to privacy concerns. The negative effect of combining targeting with obtrusiveness is strongest for people who refuse to give their income and for categories where privacy matters most, they report in the 2011 Marketing Science Journal paper. Perhaps in the end, there are natural limits to what data targeting can do for advertisers. And when we look back in 10 years at why data collection practices changed, it will not be because of regulation or self-regulation or a user uprising. No, it will be because the best ads could not be targeted. It will be because the whole idea did not work, and the best minds of the next generation will turn their attention to something else. That article was copyrighted in 2012 by the Atlantic Media Company as published in the Atlantic Online and distributed by Tribune Media Services. Now we'll turn to the Talking Point section of the Week magazine. Our first article from this section this week is Augusta, Should Women Be Members? Where was Virginia Rometty's green jacket, asked Jason Gay in the Wall Street Journal. By all rights, the new CEO of IBM deserves to be awarded the legendary blazer that signifies membership in the Augusta National Golf Club, the home of the prestigious Masters Tournament. Rometty, who was at the 18th green to see Bubba Watson win the Masters last weekend, is a golfer, a diehard fan, and the chief executive atop one of the world's most prominent companies, which happens to be a major sponsor of the event. The last four heads of IBM have been offered memberships at Augusta, where they mingle with the likes of Warren Buffett, Bill Gates, and the CEOs of ExxonMobil, AT&T, and GE. Rometty was denied a green jacket for one reason. She's a woman. And for all of its 80 years, Augusta National has been an all-male club, a tradition now woefully out of date. Does every group and club need to include both sexes to be legitimate? Said John Hawkins in HuffingtonPost.com. Do women need to take a guy on girls' night out? Augusta is a private club, and it has very legal right to set its own membership policy. You want to tell Augusta, whom it must accept as a member? Asked Sally Jennings in the Washington Post. Then try telling the same thing to the YWCA, the Sisters of the Chi Omega Sorority, and the African-American fraternities. Women can play golf at Augusta and eat lunch there. They simply aren't invited to pay thousands of dollars in membership fees. It's silly to call that a profound hardship or a social ill. No, but it is a blown opportunity, said Tom Watson in Forbes.com. Admitting Rometty to the clan of the green jacket would be symbolic, signaling an end to the institutional sexism that has kept women from the old boys' club of power and wealth. Sooner or later, Augusta will have no choice but to drop its no estrogen policy, said Rebecca Dana in the DailyBeast.com. The club stalled in admitting Jews and continued to exclude blacks until 1990, when it became too costly to its image to continue such bigotry. In recent years, HP, Xerox, Pepsi, and now IBM have installed female CEOs in the corner office. If Augusta wants to maintain its status as a center of influence, it will start tailoring its green jackets to fit the female form. The next article, Romney, the hunt for a running mate. It's over, said Ben Jacobs in the DailyBeast.com, with the GOP nomination in Mitt Romney's grasp. The suspense now shifts to his choice of a running mate. Governors Chris Christie of New Jersey and Bob McDonnell of Virginia have both been rumored. Christie for his boisterous charisma and centrist appeal, McDonnell for his social conservatism. But neither would deliver the electric jolt or the tactical advantage in November that Marco Rubio, the 40-year-old Florida senator, would. Candidates usually choose a VP who can help deliver a swing state or appeal to a voting bloc that otherwise might be lost, said Jonathan Lemire in the New York Daily News. As a dynamic young Hispanic from Florida, Rubio seems like a strong bet to do both. Those tactical picks are less effective than people assume, said George Will in the Washington Post. In the 16 general elections since World War II, 10 presidential candidates have lost the home states of their VP picks. And are Hispanics really such a homogenous cohort that adding to the Cuban-American Rubio to the ticket is going to win over Mexican-Americans in Colorado? No, what Romney really needs is someone with the intellectual firepower to expose President Obama's tax and spend budget policies. Who better than the telegenic young author of the GOP's alternative budget plan, Representative Paul Ryan? Ever since President Obama attacked Ryan's budget as heartless social Darwinism last week, said Chris Saliza in WashingtonPost.com, Ryan's stock has soared in the Veep stakes. Romney has already embraced the Ryan budget, so it makes sense to fully embrace the man, too. A woman would be better, said Laura Washington in the Chicago Sun-Times. A qualified, credible, charismatic woman could help narrow the yawning gender gap between Romney and Obama. Unfortunately, the pickings seem slim. South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley has ruled herself out, and Susana Martinez of New Mexico is an unknown, untested half-term governor. And we know how that worked out with Sarah Palin in 2008. Who says this is Romney's choice to make, said Ed Kilgore in TNR.com. Hardcore conservatives still don't trust Romney and may well now demand one of their own on the ticket. A Ryan, a Rubio, or even a Representative Alan West, a hard right congressman from Florida, as the price for their support. Romney's choice of a running mate, in other words, may be largely out of his hands. And now as we come to the end of our program, in just a couple of minutes, we'll have a few smaller notes from the news this week in the Week magazine. The U.S. just experienced the warmest start to a year since records began in 1895. Temperatures in the lower 48 states were a record-shattering 8.6 degrees above normal for March and 6 degrees higher than average for the first 3 months of this year. The number of prescriptions for opioid painkillers such as OxyContin has soared 400% in the past decade, leading to growing abuse and addiction. If doctors understood how hard it is to get patients off of these drugs, said pain specialist Dr. Jane Ballantyne, they would not prescribe them to begin with. Craft brewers such as Sierra Nevada and Samuel Adams sold 13% more beer last year, while the top 10 major brewers continued to see their sales decline. There are now more than 2,000 craft brewers in the United States. Foreign security agencies from such countries as Iran and China are using students from their nations who are studying in the U.S. to obtain cutting-edge research on information technology, lasers, and aeronautics, the FBI says. About 41% of the students at Massachusetts Institute of Technology are foreigners on visas. And over 110,000 active-duty Army troops were taking prescribed antidepressants, narcotics, sedatives, antipsychotics, and anti-anxiety drugs last year. More than 6% of the Army's active troops are currently on antidepressants. And now we will turn to the poll watch as we close our program for this week. 85% of blacks say that George Zimmerman targeted Trayvon Martin because he was a young black man. Only 41% of whites agree, while majorities of both whites, 72%, and blacks, 89%, say that in general the country is divided by race. Twice as many blacks, 40%, as whites, 20%, say that it is very divided. And we have just about run out of time for today's episode of The Week magazine. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm George Douglas. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long until next time.